seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Members of the Wisconsin State Legislature play a fundamental role in our democracy, balancing power, representing constituencies, and creating laws that have widespread impact on residents throughout the state. In doing so, they face myriad challenges, not the least of which is passing legislation that members of both political parties can support. Today, those challenges are tougher than ever, with Republicans in control of both legislative houses and a Democratic governor. In recent weeks, state lawmakers have presented and passed dozens of bills that address issues ranging from health care to education and more. But how many of those bills will actually become law, and how will they have an impact on you? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Today, we take a look at statewide legislation under consideration right now, with viewpoints from both sides of the political aisle and a chance for you to speak directly with two lawmakers deeply involved in the decision-making process. What would you like to know? You can join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions to us at ideas@wpr.org. Scott Krug of Nakusa represents the 72nd District in the Wisconsin State Assembly. Located in central Wisconsin, the district comprises the northern half of Adams County and the western half of Washera County, as well as parts of Portage and Wood counties, including Wisconsin Rapids. Representative Krug, a Republican, has served the district for more than a decade. Scott, welcome back to Route 51. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be back again.
Jody Emerson of Eau Claire is a Democrat who represents Assembly District 91. Located in western Wisconsin, the district covers most of the city of Eau Claire in northwest Eau Claire County. She has represented the district since 2019. Jody, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start off right away by talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision yesterday, that decision on redistricting that chose to adopt Governor Evers' proposed maps for the state Senate, Assembly, and Congressional districts. I want to ask each of you for your reaction to that decision. Scott, let's start with you.
You know, excuse me, right off the bat, a frog in the throat. That's a good start. but, you know, I think, you know, the maps are going to be what the maps are. And I think, you know, we've done a great job always running good candidates with good messages and the right issues. So I think in central Wisconsin, even out towards western Wisconsin, it's never really been a huge partisan problem for us to have, you know, good debate throughout our elections, you know, Republican, Democrat, depending where the lines are. You know, all in all, I think my map doesn't change at all. I mean, I've got a little sliver added in the city of Nakusa that I didn't have before, but I still have the same constituents as I would either way.
Jody, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is as good as we could have expected with the November decision that it needed to be the least changes map. And I think that's where the problem with everything lies. We have never, ever before had anything where we've had to say, let's do the least changes. We know certainly a decade ago, it was the exact opposite of least changes map. So this most recent decision, I'm happy my district stays the same. I think I lose maybe one or two wards on the edges, but, you know, I'm happy that I keep most of my same constituents. But, you know, that it is a flawed process to begin with. And, you know, the sooner we can get politicians out of the map making process, the better, because even at the Supreme Court, you know, your introduction to that talked about, the news talked about liberal and conservative justices. We know for the most part exactly where a Supreme Court decision is going to be. You know, there's very good people on the Supreme Court, but they are politicians in their own right as well. And so the sooner we can get some sort of fair nonpartisan board set up to do our map making in the future, the better. And then, you know, it does need to come to the legislature because we are responsible for it. But to tweak the maps, not sure, to draw them to begin with. And so that's the best way to go about it.
Scott, I have to wonder, with a Republican-controlled legislature and a Democratic governor, how difficult is it to pass legislation that's important to you when you know it's at risk of a veto?
Well, you know, it doesn't change the approach on how you write the bills or how you present them to the legislature. You just have to have a little more fingers crossed that they get signed when you have a governor of a different party. I think, you know, as you'll see in any other session, 90% of the bills that will get through the state house this year will get signed by the governor. I mean, the state budget was signed really quickly after the Republican legislature passed it. So I think only when it comes down to the really top 2% of stuff that's super partisan, you know, maps and, you know, things like that. Those are the things that you wouldn't expect to get a signature on. One of the things I was surprised on this session was some of the ARPA spending bills that we, you know, had priorities for our communities with. We would have thought we'd got a few signatures on those. So that might have been the only surprise I think there was. But like I said, for the most part, it's 90 to 95% of the bills that we pass that are pretty innocuous, get bipartisan votes, get signed by the governor, and get moved on without much fanfare from the media or the public. And it helps us get about our business in Wisconsin.
Jody, as a Democrat, what are you and your colleagues feeling? Are you feeling frustration that you can't get anything passed, or do you feel like the important stuff is making it through?
A little bit of both. Then that's a really good question. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but out of the bills that we have gone through this session, there was very few that were democratically written. Now, there's a lot of them that we have bipartisan authorship on. You know, where Scott and I will work together on a bill and it comes through, you know, fully bipartisan. But in the democratically written bills, my recollection is that only 7 of several hundred of them had even gotten a hearing in a committee. I think 2 or 3 had seen it to the floor and only 1 had gotten signed into law or gotten to the governor's desk. So it is very partisan on what is even presented on the floor. You know, like I said earlier, there's a decent chunk where we're working together on stuff, but there are things on the edges, and our stuff doesn't even get looked at. And, you know, we're going to hear over the next few months about, you know, percentages of bipartisan approaches and things like that. But there is definitely an editorial process about what even gets looked at, because the Republicans are in charge of the committees and the Republicans are in charge of what gets heard in the committees. And so they just leave a lot of our stuff off the table altogether.
Let's talk about election issues. Scott, you released a statement in November weighing in on the 2020 election in Wisconsin. In that statement, you said that Wisconsin's election process had, and this is the quote from your statement, had multiple points in which the public can question the integrity of the system. And I know this week the Assembly put several bills on a fast track. One seeks to amend the state constitution to add a photo ID requirement for voting. Another that would prohibit private donations to help with election administration. Can you explain what those bills would do?
You know, honestly, it's to restore confidence. I mean, whether it's perceived or whether it's reality, there is a huge confidence problem in our electorate on how our elections are perceived to be accurate and counted. You know, honestly, in Adams County, Wood County, Portage County, Washera County, I know we don't have problems. We talk to our local clerks. We know that they administer the elections greatly. That's not an issue. But we know that, for example, one of the bills that we wanted to pass this week that we almost had bipartisan support on, actually, was the Monday processing of absentee ballots. Just so we can get rid of that perception in the end of the night where there's 30,000 ballots to be counted at the end of the night and people go to bed thinking one person's ahead and they wake up the next person's winning. I think that was the singular jumping off point where all of this election stuff kind of fell off the rails, as people assumed that there was a big ballot dump or that new ballots had been created somehow, when in reality it wasn't. I mean, we told people all along that we knew that we had a lot of absentee ballots out there because of COVID. We knew the counts every day from WEC and how many ballots were out there. But still, perception among people, no matter how much we tried to portray it to them, was that ballots were being created at the end of the night. You know, one person took over while I was sleeping. How do we fix that? So that's why we tried to do this Monday process bill together to say, hey, let's get this started, get this process moving, make sure there's accurate reporting back to people at the end of the night from each of our municipalities, how many ballots are out there, how many have been counted, how many are left. So I think those are the things that are out there. And like I said, a lot of this might be more perception than reality, but I still think it's coming down to how do we let private dollars influence elections in certain communities? How do we count absentee ballots when there's such a huge amount of them? How do we deal with these new problems that we never anticipated before? And those are real problems that have to be dealt with, because, you know, COVID really threw off these elections and changed the entire dynamic of how our elections are run. So ballot curing, ballot harvesting, drop boxes, nursing home stuff. I mean, all of those things are being talked about right now They're not made up issues. Those are things that all happen in all our communities. Now we just have to figure out what the impact of those were and how to deal with that impact.
You're listening to Route 51 with Republican Representative Scott Krug and Democratic Representative Jody Emerson. I want to remind callers that they can reach us at 800-780-9742 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jody, what is the Unlock the Vote legislation that you introduced in February? What is it?
So that is, it's a package of bills that is making sure that there's a couple different bills with it. The one that I'm most excited about is for all of our county jails to have a process in place where people who are allowed to vote, maybe they're being held on pretrial hearing, maybe they're in there for a misdemeanor and haven't had their rights to vote taken away, that they have an ability to vote while in jail. Eau Claire County has done a really good job of that for the last couple of elections. We have a private group that comes in and helps people get registered to vote, get their absentee ballot. I think that should be happening in all 72 counties. There's no reason why we shouldn't be making sure that people who are allowed to vote can vote. The other piece of the Unlock the Vote package is that people who are out on paper, so probation and parole, that once they are out of prison, they get their right to vote. And our research has found that while there's a significant amount of people who are off papers in a year or so after leaving prison, there's also a large amount of people who are on papers for sometimes 20 or 30 years. And these are people who have a job, are involved in our communities, and the elections that they want to have a say in most of all are their school board races, their county board, their city council. It's the small ones that affect them the most that they want to be involved in. And when we're talking about 20 years without being able to vote, when they're taxpaying citizens, we're really getting back down to the fundamentals of taxation without representation. And that's why I want to start this conversation about who is allowed to vote and how can we make sure that people are allowed to vote.
Scott, there's a lot of debate over whether the state should accept Medicaid expansion. This is still a big topic of discussion. The nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau said last year that the state could save more than $1.6 billion over 2 years by expanding Medicaid. But what issues are keeping some lawmakers from supporting that?
It's a great question. So I chair the Public Benefit Reform Committee for the last few sessions, and I've been on it since its creation. That's my background. That's kind of my wheelhouse that I like to work in. So I think the biggest thing to understand is even while we're trying to right-size our benefit programs, we have the best coverage in the country with our Badger Care program already. This is a program that covers these folks that are in that gap area to make sure that if you have problems with poverty and you need coverages, Badger Care allows it. Senior Care is another program that fills that gap too. So when we look at the politics of accepting Medicaid for all or expanding Medicaid, those are things that we cover really well in the state of Wisconsin already to take on that additional ownership of the federal government over our state programs is a tough thing to sell for a lot of Republicans in our caucus. And I think that's something that, as long as we have these gap programs in place, I think this is the way we're going to maintain the process.
You're listening to Democratic State Representative Jody Emerson of Eau Claire and Republican State Representative Scott Krug of Nakusa. Our guest today on Route 51 as we look at what's happening in Madison and how bills now being proposed could have an impact on you. This is also an opportunity for you to ask questions directly of the lawmakers who represent you. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, joined by two members of the Wisconsin State Assembly, Republican Scott Krug of Nakusa and Democrat Jody Emerson of Eau Claire, for a discussion on what's happening at the State House and the impact on local communities. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Just before the break, we were talking about Medicaid expansion. Jody, Democrats just rolled out an ambitious effort to expand access to health care for Wisconsinite, the Badger Care Public Option Act. What's behind that proposal, and do you think it's a compromise if the state isn't going to expand Medicaid?
You know, the whole Medicaid expansion, and I'm glad that you gave me a chance to talk about this, because I really want to talk about some of the things that Scott said. You know, we're talking about people who maybe aren't in poverty per se with the Medicare expansion. We're talking about people who are at 133% of the poverty level. So barely above it. And most of the time, these are people who either have a couple of part-time jobs that they're adding together, or their company doesn't offer insurance to them. And so I think it's our responsibility when somebody is working full time. I figured out what 133% of the poverty level is. A full time CNA and somebody working about 35 hours a week at minimum wage would be at 133%. So these are not people who are, you know, barely eking, you know, not trying to participate in society, but they don't maybe have an opportunity to get insurance through their companies. I don't understand how all of a sudden 133% of the poverty level is this panacea for wealth, that they can afford things. And for some reason, the expanding Medicare has just been a line in the sand that the Republicans are never willing to look at. And so we are trying to figure out ways of making sure that people are covered in Wisconsin at a way that is affordable for them. You know, yes, they can get things on the exchange, but sometimes those have such a huge deductible, and it really does tend to be a problem when it comes right down to what your, you know, if you've got 133% of the poverty level, you don't have the money for a $10,000 deductible. You do have the money for a $100 deductible that you might get under Medicaid, though. So by not expanding Medicaid, what I think this is just a bunch of corporate welfare, and we're letting some of our companies go off without being necessitated to offer fair and decent insurance to their workers. And so I look at it for what's best for our workers and our people. Apparently the Republicans look at it from what's best for the companies. So one of the things that we've tried doing now is this public option. If we're not going to be able to get Medicaid expanded in the budget, which we've tried over the last couple of years, let's try this a different way. We need to make sure, in order to have people healthy and productive members of society, they need to have medical coverage, and whether that's for physical or mental issues. So how can we make sure that they are adequately covered? This is another option for us.
Jody brought up the, you know, the economy a little bit here by talking about the cost of living. I know that's on people's minds, and there's been a lot of discussion about the rising cost of rent, lack of affordable housing throughout the state. So Scott, what kinds of legislative solutions do you see? Is there a statewide solution for this, for the rising cost of rent? Or is it something that you see as more of a local issue?
So I think one of the challenges we have when we're dealing with issues of rent and poverty and those things are all of the money that's flown into the state from CARES and from ARPA and all of these other things that are being expended across the state through the federal monies that have come in left and right. You know, if you look right now for rental assistance, energy assistance, healthcare assistance, community programming, community development programming, all of these things are being, you know, there's hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars going towards all of these individual communities and programs across the state of Wisconsin. Rent issues and keeping, you know, expendable incomes and expendable monies in people's pockets. I mean, that's a taxation issue. We need to make sure that we're not taxing people out of their ability to rent anymore, especially with inflation happening as rampantly as it is. We need to make sure that disposable income is one of the things that we can drive towards. We need to find a way to have our benefit cliff legislation introduced here so that people that are on benefit programs can have an incentive to work while still receiving their benefits, so they're not dropped off entirely and have no incentives to go back to get, you know, more hours at their employer or a better job somewhere else. I mean, these are all the issues that we deal with on a regular basis in public benefit reform, is to say, how do we make this committee more of an anti-poverty committee than anything else? Make sure that our housing programs are accepting federal dollars like they should, to make sure that there's connectivity between governmental agencies to protect the most vulnerable among us who need the programming and dollars that we have available without expending those on folks that aren't eligible for our programs or are not able to go back to work, so we can have the money that we need to put towards assisting individuals who are actually in need.
You are both on the Committee for Government Accountability and Oversight. One of the items in committee relates to regulating and addressing PFAS. I know that you both feel strongly about the PFAS issue. Jody, where do those efforts stand right now?
You know, that really hasn't seemed like it's been a... it's a complicated issue. And we saw recently with the DNR board that even it's a complicated issue at that level. I think there needs to be a lot better understanding with some of my colleagues about what PFAS are. We're not testing all around the state. And so a lot of people like to say, oh, that's a problem in French Island. That's a problem in Marinette. Well, it's a problem there because they've done the testing. They've discovered it. We've recently had an issue in Eau Claire in our public wells with it that we've been able to mitigate pretty decently. But I am fearful for the municipalities who are not testing for PFAS. Eau Claire did it on a proactive level to see where we were at and found the problem. I'm fearful for those communities that are not testing on a regular basis. And I think if every community were to test, they would find out that they do have some issues with PFAS. And if they don't now, they're going to soon. And this is where it is really important that we are using our DNR to hold polluters accountable. PFAS don't just magically appear. They're coming from manufacturing and other places. And how are we making sure that things are permitted correctly, that we know what is coming in and going out into our systems, and holding those people accountable. That's a big piece of it.
Scott, I know that you also have strong feelings about PFAS. What do you think needs to happen to protect the public?
So there needs to be a statewide testing program. Representative Emerson is 100% correct. I mean, Michigan took on this, bit off this apple last session in their legislative priorities, and all 168 of their municipal treatment centers were tested. The vast majority of them know that they have a PFAS issue going on right now. The vast majority of them have implemented granular activated charcoal processing systems at their municipal treatment levels. That's a place the state could make a good investment in once we realize what dollars we have available. It's not an issue so much of the manufacturers to be held accountable. I think most of these PFAS that are manufactured are from decades past. Manufacturing in PFAS right now is limited firefighting foam for the most part. So we're not going to catch too many manufacturers anymore introducing these materials. But we do need to be available on the backside to make sure the municipal treatment centers have every tool they need to be put in place to treat the water for their municipal treatment facilities. And beyond that, we're going to have to figure out a way to treat for individuals who have groundwater and wells in the state of Wisconsin, too. We haven't figured out how to do that, or other states haven't yet either.
Scott, is the 70 parts per trillion that the DNR board settled on appropriate for a standard right now?
You know, I think as far as where the Natural Resources Board is going to come down on that, I think that's where they're going to end up. I know the federal government would like us to be at the 20 parts per trillion, so there's going to have to be an in-between there somewhere if we're ever going to get anything done. Arguing about the limit is where we're going to get stalled on treating anything and solving the problems down the road. So whatever limit it's going to be, we've got to settle on it quick and start solving these problems.
Jody, what do you think the limit should be? I know the EPA is expected to weigh in on this later this year.
I mean, first of all, I'm just stuck on the fact that he said that I was correct on something. So I'm just going to go with that.
I've said that before, just maybe not publicly. Okay.
Just in case anybody wonders, we can actually have fun together. So I think it's important, first of all, to have a limit, and we need to start there with something. But, you know, I think it comes down to the fact that are you willing to, and I don't mean anybody on this call, just you in the general people, are you willing to give your children water that has 70 parts per trillion, or would you rather do 20? When it comes down to that, you know, it's okay if we're looking in the ambiguous, but what do you want coming out of your tap? What do you want your children or your grandchildren ingesting? What do you want yourself ingesting? And we need to look at that, but we need to start somewhere and we need to get something on the books. But I think, you know, the more safe, the better.
Scott,
we're talking about people's health. So
sure. Scott, there's been a lot of controversy about the Natural Resources Board and Fred Prain. He's refusing to step away from the board, even though his term ended. Why hasn't there been a confirmation hearing for the governor's new pick?
You know, if I could explain anything in the state Senate, I would gladly dive into those issues. So there's another thing Jody and I are going to agree on. I don't know. I mean, that's state Senate has got a different set of responsibilities than the assembly does. And, you know, honestly, I can't make heads or tails out of what they do sometimes.
Well, let's shift a little bit to Lincoln Hills. I know that's not in either of your districts, but it is in central Wisconsin. A lot of our listeners care about what's happening there. Last week, the assembly approved funding to replace Lincoln Hills by a unanimous vote. And that came just a few days after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he thought the measure was unlikely to pass. Scott, what changed?
Well, I think the one thing that changed was a little outside pressure politically. I think, you know, one of the candidates running for governor weighed into, you know, speaker's office and said, hey, it would probably be a good thing if you guys did this. So maybe that helped him change his mind. But in reality, this is something that's been a bipartisan effort for years and years and years. And I know it's stalled in the in-between here, but a lot of credit to Representative Evan Goyke and Representative Mike Schrod to get this much needed in, you know, legislation across the finish line. And, you know, however the governor's going to implement it after he signs this bill. I mean, that's great that he was able to sign this, that we were able to pass it. The in-between, I don't know. I mean, sometimes that inside baseball stuff gets kind of murky, but I think having that outside influence was a bit helpful to the speaker's office to change their direction.
Jody, in his State of the State address this year, Governor Evers called on lawmakers to make a few things happen. One was to allocate more than $130 million in child care and tax credits and $750 million to schools. I'm going to talk about child care a little bit later on, but Jody, I'd like to get your thoughts on the school funding proposal. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen our schools, if we want to talk about frontline workers through the pandemic, our schools are definitely frontline workers for this. And we know, and we'll touch on this later when we get to the childcare, that making sure that your kids have a place to go makes it so that people can get to work. And so it is part of our workforce piece. We have for decades had a broken system when it comes to school funding. Eau Claire gets a different amount than La Crosse, even though we're very similar school sizes, because of a couple of decades ago when the formula was locked in, we had a different approach to funding things. And so we need to look at that, and we need to make sure that we're transparent with our school funding. We need to make sure that public dollars are going to public schools, and we need to make sure that across the state, our schools are adequately funded. When school funding is tied to property values, we're never going to have an equal approach to how much kids are getting. Then it really does depend on the zip code that you live in will determine your education outcomes. Chris Larson and I, Senator Larson and I, have a bill that would put voucher transparency on your tax roll. So when you get your tax, your property taxes at the end of the year, you've got city and county and school and, you know, sometimes like a technical college line on there. It would also have a line under the school funding so that you know how much of your public school dollars are going to your voucher schools out of your property taxes. And I think that's important. It doesn't change how much money is going there, but it makes sure that you know. I don't think a lot of people in the city of Eau Claire know that $2 million of their public school dollars are going to voucher schools every single year. So I think that's an important piece for education.
on the student side, since we're talking about K-12 issues, Scott, you've advocated for financial literacy for all Wisconsin students. What would that look like?
So originally, the bill that I passed 4 years ago that was signed into law was one sentence saying, every school, we want you to do financial literacy. You figure out how to do it, but we want every student introduced to these concepts before they leave your doors upon graduation. Now, there's been follow-up attempts at legislation to require certain amounts of credits and certain types of participation. You know, I've heard from my smaller schools, you know, like Representative Emerson said, if we put too much pressure on them, we're exacerbating budgets. So the pressure to put on them with prescripted numbers of credits and things like that is a tougher road to hoe for me. But I do want to keep following up with our state schools on how they're implementing the bill that we passed a few years ago and how they're introducing financial literacy to all of their students. You know, back when I was, you know, I'm not going to say how long ago, obviously, but back when I was a student, you know, we always hear those stories about how we did our home ec classes and how we were able to learn how to balance a checkbook. And a lot of the stuff that I know parents will say, especially my side of the aisle, parents will say, well, this is the parents' responsibility. Why don't you guys stay out of it? Unfortunately, a lot of parents were never introduced to these concepts either. So trying to rely on that as the main source of information for those students is tougher and tougher these days. So that's where I'm coming from with financial literacy, making sure all of our students know exactly how to balance a checkbook, how to look for good investments, how to make sure they're not going to Miller Park in the summer and sign up for a stupid credit card offer just because they get a free t-shirt. I mean, those are common sense things that I think I like working on a lot. You know, just to really touch quickly on that funding stuff, I think, you know, for the first time in my 12 years in the legislature, I finally don't have schools calling me begging us for more money. I mean, that's a nice thing that we've had so far this session between CARES and ESSER money and, you know, all of the funds that we're able to introduce ourselves and money through the formula. Schools are finally sitting pretty good. I know the changes when we don't have one source or one-time money coming in next session, but that's something we get to talk about in the next state budget.
The Assembly also passed a bill that makes some changes related to substitute teacher permits issued. Scott, I know you voted yes on this. Jody, you voted no. The Wisconsin Association of School Boards supports the initiative. What are the drawbacks that you see, Jody?
You know, I think any time that we are taking away, you know, I think about with student, or excuse me, substitute teachers, sometimes they're there for several months at a time, and to not have them be qualified teachers makes me question things. Anytime we're taking more and more requirements away, I think we are devaluing the profession. I think a good way to go about filling in the gap for not having as many teachers right now is to make sure that we can get some of these retired teachers back on the front lines from a substitute teaching or a long-term substitute teaching piece. And if that happens for a couple of years until we can get more people into the profession, you know, then that's what happens. And so, you know, I think there's other ways of looking at it other than getting rid of the requirements for who should be teaching our students. And also, I really struggled with the fact that you could have somebody as young as 20 in the high schools teaching, you know, 18 and 19 year olds. I thought that was just opening it up for some problems.
Scott, I'd like to invite you to give your thoughts since you voted for the bill.
Yeah, you know, I mean, on the age thing, I think we have legislators in their 20s. I mean, so I don't know if that holds a lot of water on the age argument, but I think to have people who are interested, who want to get involved in the classroom, who show that they have a dedication towards it, I think that's a great first step. And I think that's something we should be looking towards, is making sure that we're encouraging people in our communities to be involved. You know, whether it's getting involved with our schools or involved in other activities across our communities, I think it's a great first step. And if the School Board Association thinks it's good enough for me.
You're hearing a discussion with two members of the Wisconsin State Assembly, Democrat Jody Emerson and Republican Scott Krug, for a discussion on the latest legislative proposals now under consideration in Madison. We'd like to hear from you. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guests today are Republican Scott Krug and Democrat Jody Emerson, two members of the Wisconsin State Assembly, for a roundup of legislation under discussion now in Madison. This is also an opportunity for you to speak directly with these two lawmakers by calling us at 800-780-9742. If you prefer, you can email questions to us at ideas@wpr.org. There are hopeful signs that the pandemic is easing, the number of infections, hospitalizations, deaths, all dropping throughout the state, and vaccination continues to be controversial in some ways. Scott, you introduced a bill barring vaccine discrimination. Tell us about that.
So this was Assembly Bill 316. It's one of the package of bills that the Assembly had introduced on forced vaccinations. I think this one was the most innocuous of them all. I think this one basically says, if you're looking to get government services, the government in a county courthouse or what be it, can't ask you for a vaccination card just for you to come to apply for services. It's similar along the lines of what we talk about all the time from my friends on the other side of the aisle, that government should be free and open and accessible to everyone. I don't know why we would start cutting off at this point because of a vaccination status. So we're using, you know, standard procedures, whether there's 6-foot distancing, you know, whether there's masking going on. I don't think a vaccination card is really pertinent when it comes to folks applying for social service benefits or things like that.
Jody, what is your perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I'm still stuck on Scott saying forced vaccinations. I haven't had any knowledge of anybody being forced to have a vaccine, even in places that are requiring precautions, it's usually you either show your vaccine card or a negative test. And when we're talking about a communicable disease, your freedoms end where my body begins. And this is really personal to me. I'm an immune compromised person who has had the vaccine. I've had the booster. But I'm, because of the medications I'm on, we don't know whether the vaccine has even taken in my body or not. And because of the, and I'm one of thousands of people around the state that have health issues that, you know, whether it's cancer patients, immune compromised people, organ transplant patients, where our lives are in danger by having to sit next to somebody who isn't wearing a mask when there is a surge. And that's scary. And you know, I'm all for people being able to do what they want to with their body, but when what they're doing with their body infringes on my right to life, that's difficult. And I'll just let it go at that, because I could go for a long time on this whole issue.
All right. Republicans have keyed in on the state's ongoing workforce challenges this year. I want to spend some time talking about that. Some are calling the labor shortage one of the biggest struggles across our state. Scott, what are some viable legislative solutions to this problem?
You know, like I mentioned earlier, this benefit cliff legislation that we started working on 6 years ago has finally got the public hearing this session. This is a bill that is really key to this problem, is where you have individuals who have a family of four who's receiving, you know, $400 a month on food share. If they're making $12 an hour at Walmart, working 25 to 30 hours a week, if they take a raise of $1 an hour, or if they take 5 hours extra of work, the benefit drops almost nothing, $10 a month. So we've got to find a way that while these people are transitioning back into work or finding better opportunities, that the state's not going to punish them to do so. That is one of the biggest problems we have with our social benefit systems right now, is it's all or nothing. Either you're on this program or you're going to get a benefit. We have to find a way to balance those two things out, whether it's in food share, housing, childcare. We did the childcare benefit cliff legislation a couple sessions ago. You know, all along the way throughout the path of every social agency that we have in the state of Wisconsin that provides benefit, got to find a way to balance those between the workforce needs of the employer, the workforce needs of the employee, and the budget of the state of Wisconsin. So finding a way to balance those is highly important, making sure that we have great apprenticeship programs throughout our tech colleges, making sure that we've got people that, you know, are able to go to work, that want to go to work, that they have a social agency that can help them find work if they don't know how to find work. So there's a thousand things that between the Workforce Development Committee and the Public Benefit Reform Committee that we've worked on together to make sure that everybody who's eligible, who wants to work, can go to work.
Jody, the labor shortage was a problem before the pandemic hit. What are some of the biggest hurdles, and what do you think lawmakers need to do?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I look at this from a different perspective than Scott does. First of all, we've got historically low unemployment. So we don't have a lot of people who are, you know, trying to find jobs that don't want jobs. If they're not working, it's because they don't have to work. I would never want us to get to a society where we're having to force people to work just to make companies better. If you've worked and you've saved up and you're able to retire early, well, good for you. The other thing that I think is lost in this whole piece is the culture war that we have in Wisconsin. When we have, you know, women's reproductive rights are under assault in Wisconsin. When we are picking on transgender children, and when we are doing every hot button topic that Alec wants people to be putting into the statutes, you know, when we've got heartbeat bills coming up, that tells people who are in Wisconsin and people who are looking to move to Wisconsin that there's a culture war in Wisconsin, and people look at that before they decide to move to a place. When people are looking to move to a place to start up their family or to move their family there, they're looking at the culture of the area, of what is going on and how people are going to be accepted. And when my Republican colleagues keep on putting these bills out that are assault on people who are different than them, it tells people you are not wanted in Wisconsin. And I think that is a big piece of our problem in Wisconsin, why people are either leaving or choosing to not come here in the first place.
Continuing the vein of jobs, Scott, what's going on with the paper mill issue?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I've spent, you know, the last 20 months on straight, is trying to figure out a way to find acceptable paths forward. So right now, the Wisconsin Rapids Mill has been bought out by a Swedish company where we had an opportunity for a local ownership group to come in. The Park Falls Mill has been shuttered completely. It's shut down. It's been auctioned off. Parts are coming out the door. Those things could have been easily solved earlier this session. We had Assembly Bill 367, the mill bill. We had a second crack at it going through the state Senate. Of course, the mill bill was vetoed. We were looking for ARPA dollars to be invested into that project. Now, coming back this last week, we see $15 million of ARPA money going to remove coal piles in Green Bay, and you know, all of these community investment ARPA dollars finally coming out the door after, you know, sessions kind of concluded. That was the fear with this money, is it was going to sit in a pot that was going to be used arbitrarily by the governor without input from the legislature. And now he's taking up the advice of the legislature on several of these things we put through his bills, which he vetoed earlier. So that's the confusing part, is are we going to make investments in these programs? Are we going to make investments in these communities? This is a great investment to make. This is a local ownership group that, if we were able to secure some ARPA dollars, would be able to get this mill functioning again, to get 1,000 people back in the door in Wisconsin Rapids, to get a couple hundred people back in the doors of Park Falls working. When people are looking to come to the state of Wisconsin, they're not looking at culture wars. They're looking at internet access. They're looking at job availability. They're looking at industries that have strength. They're looking at good taxation codes. They're looking for these things for government to be able to help, and saying, okay, community, here's something viable for you. Getting the Wisconsin Rapids Mill operational again, something more viable than anything else for the Wisconsin Rapids area and for the entire Northwoods of the state of Wisconsin for forestry and paper jobs.
Scott Krug, Jody Emerson, our guests today on Route 51, and the number to call is 800-780-9742. One of the themes that comes up frequently in labor shortage discussions, and we touched just briefly on this earlier, is a lack of affordable child care. Jody, could making child care more affordable help solve the labor shortage? What can state lawmakers do on that front?
You know, we have a very decent surplus right now in our budget, and whether it is ARPA dollars or surplus dollars, we need to be investing in offsetting some of these costs. Child care is a workforce development issue. If people do not have a safe and secure place to have their kids, they will not enter the workforce. That's that's just a top priority for just about every parent I know, is my child safe and secure first? But we cannot afford, it's not an industry that can just survive on its own. We really do need to have some government offsets and some government funding in there in order to make it viable. Child care workers are some of the lowest paid workers out there, and they're not going to jump in and do that unless they can make their ends meet. But we can't rely simply on parents to be able to do that. Parents can't afford, you know, $20,000 per kid in order to make this happen. So we're going to have to figure out a way, whether it's from a combination of federal and state dollars, to help offset this, because it just it's not a business model that can continue to work.
Scott, what legislative solutions do you see to the child care affordability issue?
Well, one of the things that we worked on when I was the chairman of Children and Families a few sessions back was trying to make sure that our Young Star program was viable, to make sure that child care providers could actually qualify for assistance from the government because they had quality child care programs. I think the way that program is set up right now, it makes it too tough for a lot of providers to be able to reach the 4 and 5 star level that would qualify them for some more assistance. I think that's something we've got to tweak and find a way to adjust that. That's a good avenue for us to use to make those investments in, is making sure that if we're going to be investing, that we're making it viable for these child care providers to have good quality, acceptable child care for parents to trust in. So I think that is the first step, is making sure that program is operational to the best of its ability, that we can throw dollars into it from there.
Jody, in his State of the State address, the governor suggested giving $150 checks to every Wisconsin resident. Are we going to get those checks, or is that dead in the water?
I think the way that my Republican colleagues look at it is they do not want to see the governor have any sort of win in an election year. So while it would make sense, from our monetary situation with the surplus that we have, it would make sense for the people of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, it doesn't make sense for whatever Republican governor candidate that they're going to have. And as we heard earlier, apparently the governor candidates kind of rule the caucus and force votes on different bills. So I don't see this coming anytime soon, even though it would be a win for every single person in Wisconsin.
Scott, no checks? Are we
no
not
checks.
Getting checks?
No, absolutely no checks. So don't count on that check coming in the mail, because when we have a projected surplus, it doesn't mean we have an actual surplus. So we can't be sending checks out right now. And if we do have those dollars available, it should be going to overly reducing the tax burden on the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. If we can flatten those income taxes across the board through the next two state budgets, we get to a point where we're going to save a heck of a lot more than $150 for each individual in the state of Wisconsin.
We have Martha from Menominee on the line with a question. Martha, thanks for calling.
Yeah, you could use, to pay back the taxpayers, you could use some of that almost $700,000 that the Wisconsin taxpayers got footed with to fund a fraudulent inquiry and investigation into an election that didn't have any problems. I spoke with the Attorney General's office. It appears that Mr. Gableman has committed what they call fraudulent business practices. I want to know how the taxpayers can get this money back.
All right. We have about a minute left, so I want to ask you each in 30 seconds to answer Martha's question. Scott, let's start with you.
Yeah, I'll give you 10 seconds. I think any investigation that we can do to restore confidence in our elections is worth the money, whether it's agree upon or not in the results, but it's something we're going to keep doing just to make sure people have confidence in elections.
Jody, briefly, what's the answer to that question?
I think people have confidence in our elections, and it's some of our elected officials that are keep on talking about this that reduce everybody's confidence in elections. This Gableman, and I'm on campaigns and elections, so this has been a big part of my year. This Gableman hearing investigation has been a sham from the beginning. Robin Voss did it because he was getting hit from the extremes of his party. And what this is just another chance for him to pacify everybody. So, it's a sham of an investigation. It should have never happened.
Thank you. I just very briefly, 10 seconds each, with so much political division, where do you see opportunities to work together? Scott?
Yeah, we talked about it before. Clean water, workforce development, child care. I mean, those are the things we talked about this hour that I think we'll find some common ground on. The other bigger things, you know, we're not going to find the common ground always, but Lincoln Hills is a great example.
Jody, 10 seconds.
I think with the new maps, we're going to have people who are going to have to fight harder for their jobs. And I think that makes them more responsive to their constituents, which will in the end bring us together.
Thank you both, Democratic State Representative Jody Emerson and Republican State Representative Scott Krug. Our producers today are Joy Ratch-Kramer, Kate Spranger, and Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at WPR.org/Route 51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.